Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Obviously, wearing there, Mario gets sent off and Roberto comes in with a suitcase and Louis Vuitton suitcase is getting absolutely thrown across the dressing room. So many messages come through, like, at the time saying, did this really happen? Did that happen? I know some Italian only through Roberto, and it's all bad language. So whenever I've met any Italian players over the years, I'll recite these words that I know fluently because I've heard them so many times being launched at Mario mainly.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Talking City podcast all about Manchester City. And today in the international break, I'm delighted to say we are joined by Steve Aziz, who was a Manchester City kit man during a very exciting time a few years ago. How are you, Steve?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Cheers for having us on time.
Oh, it's all right. It's all right. Yeah, like I say, there are just so many stories, and I was kind of doing my prep this morning and getting ready, and then I saw you'd done a bit of prep yourself, and just the it was because the thing is, Manchester City today are obviously a very exciting team to watch, but the stories that were in the Mancini era are just kind of unrivaled, it feels.
I'd be probably a bit biased, and I'd totally agree that because it was just every day you're going into the training ground and there was just something going on, something's happened, or there was a newspaper story and so many messages come through, like, at the time saying, did this really happen? Did that happen?
Yeah. And so when did you join City?
So I joined City in September 2010. It was short and sweet, I'd say. 18 months I was sort of in and out, FA Cup, Premier League, and then chance to move back to the North East. I took it with both hands, but like what happened in between, obviously we'll get onto it, and it was crazy.
Yeah. And what had you done before joining City?
So I was started off. My mum worked in the laundry at Middlesbrough, so that was sort of my pathway into football, into professional football. And I had a football injury. I was sort of playing at a decent level. I'd played in a few academy teams at Middlesbrough, and for one reason or another, injury maybe not being good enough, I ended up coming out of the game and sort of playing semi-professionally and doing a college course, and then a bad football injury sort of meant that I couldn't finish my college course. And at that time in football, if you knew someone in the game, you could sort of get your way in that way. And that's how I got into professional football at Middlesbrough.
Right. And then how did you, progress into sort of becoming a kit man?
Yeah, so I was just helping out day to day, started with like blowing up balls, sort of apprenticeship sort of jobs, and helping out folding a few towels and doing a few run around jobs for the players and things, and got to know a lot of people really quickly, learned from some really good kit managers, and yeah, the obviously the opportunity come up at Man City quite early into sort of my kit role, and it wasn't really known that kit men moved around, and I think I was probably one of the first ones to sort of move clubs. I mean, there's quite a lot of moving around now with physios, medical department, and kit managers do move on a bit. So I sort of think I was probably one of the first ones to move from a club.
Yeah, why? I guess people just sort of stay and stay forever, don't they? Like,
I think you probably sort of see it as a job for life, because that I initially did see it as that, and you think like to. If you can't be a professional footballer, probably the next best thing to be in around that environment is to be either therapist or in sports science. Or for me, it was a kit man.
Yeah, because it is such an important role within the squad, isn't it? Because you more than almost anyone else are with the players kind of every day and every match day, just kind of in and around that environment.
The players more than I'd see my family, like even up until really recently, like I'd be there with them, travel away with them, training ground every day. Obviously a lot of people day to day, you spend a lot of time at work rather than you do at home. By the time the kids have gone to bed and things, before you know it, it's done, where the training ground in the morning, we could be there 8 o'clock till 3 o'clock in the afternoon, like spending 6 hours, 8-10 hours a day on some of the away trips. You spend a lot of time with these people and you really get to know them really, really well and really closely, and know what they like and what they don't like, and who are the ones you can speak to openly, the ones that need a bit of arm around them. So yeah, you really do spend a lot of time with these guys.
And so talk us through sort of your day, your week, sort of what would your role entail basically?
Yeah, it's sort of changed a little bit, and how I'd seen it at Manchester City was how I want to carry it on, because how it was at Middlesbrough, we sort of had like a serving hatch and the players would come in the morning, come and they'd give you their number and they'd collect the kit and then they'd go off away. Where when I'd come to Manchester City, Chappie obviously is well known by a lot of City supporters and people in and around, and he was in there and he was really the one that sort of showed me like, this is the way we're going to do things. And I took that on with me for the rest of my career as a kit man. It was really was looking after the players and sort of taking their minds away, any sort of thing that they didn't need to worry about, we would do that for them, whether it be putting packages in the car, dropping off a tracksuit for them because they forgot it, any sort of thing that they needed. Chappie was really like, we need to do this for them. And I wouldn't say mollycoddle, but it was really like, just do everything for them, these guys, so that when it comes to training, when it comes to the match day, they don't need to worry about anything else because we're looking after them things for them. And we had a good team. I mean, obviously, Brandon's still there now, me and Chappie. So we'd get in the morning. I think we'd probably 8 o'clock in the morning be the first ones in. I think maybe it's even earlier now. Again, just to beat the traffic in around Manchester, because everyone knows that site and its stuff's got worse over the years. So you should probably get in the training ground. You need to be the first one as a kit man, because you've got to be there before anyone else so they can get you changed into the kit. So we'd get in the morning. We'd see the girls in the laundry. There's a couple of girls in there, and we'd get the kit from them. We'd go and put it out into the individual spaces for the first team. And then when we were at Carrington at the time, it wasn't really, I think you had the elite development group, which was looked after by Andy Walsh. And they were sort of there ready in case we need to take a couple of players, or if we had a big squad in the Champions League, they'd need to come over. But there wasn't really any academy sort of players in around that at the time. So we'd be looking after them, making sure their kit's out, then we put the staff kit out, and then I think me or Brandon at the time would probably cover training, making sure that the manager and the staff had everything they needed, equipment-wise, balls. And I know still to this day now, from speaking to Brandon quite recently, that's still a key part of it, that the lads are playing now, making sure that Pep's got everything they need for training and getting really involved and making sure that they've got everything that they need.
Yeah, and are you sort of having those conversations every week with the manager every day to sort of check what he needs, or is there kind of a set template of, you know, he knows what he wants and doesn't really change?
I can't speak for what's happening now, but at the time there wasn't really a great working relationship between the kit department and Mancini. Like, some of his staff were really nice fellas, the goalkeeping coach, and I mean, David Platt, Kiddo. Like, I really think there was a bit of a divide between the Italian staff and the English staff, and they did their own things and we did our own things. And if they wanted something from the English staff, they would literally get one of the staff to come over and just get one of the lads to do it. I really did feel that divide between the staff all the way through my time there.
And what was the dressing room like when you walked in? Because, you know, big personality of a manager, big personality for players, all trying to sort of topple United. What was it like?
I think I feel really lucky that when I got there was a strong, I think you got to really give the credit to Brian Marwood, obviously sort of building up this team, and the backbone of the team that we had. We had like England nationals, you had Joe Hart, Les Scott, Micah Richards, Gareth Barry, James Milner. You look at them, these guys are playing for England on every national break. And then when I'm going to that dressing room, I'm thinking, wow. And then these lads sort of gelled with the international lads, David Silva, Balotelli, Aguero, Tevez. I think the combination that Brian had sort of pulled together, and because I think there might have been one of the first teams to sort of have that model where you have the head coach, where it's really popular now, and you have the chief exec, sport and director choosing the players and bringing them in, and then the manager sort of has his input maybe on signings, but ultimately Brian's bringing the recruitment team are bringing these players in. And when you look at the backbone of the team that I had, and Nigel de Jong bringing them in sort of placing, I mean, I feel like I'm name dropping here, but what an incredible amount of players. Like, it's just players on players. But I think to have that strong English contingency in there was the real backbone, the catalyst of the team to go on and do what they did in the next two seasons while I was there.
Yeah, and were the English boys the sort of the loudest in the dressing room?
Yeah, so I really got on well, because I was a bit of a goalkeeper myself, and to see Joe Hart, like one of my heroes, and I'm watching Joe play, and I'm like totally gobsmacked because this guy's making saves that he shouldn't have been making, and it was just like totally blown away to see what Joe was doing week to week and the great saves he was making. And then in the dressing room, he's like really just really loud, and got on really, really well with all the kit lads and all the staff there. I loved Joe, and I think like the sort of the backup keepers that we had, Stuart Taylor was there. Obviously, had some really good experience at Arsenal, and he's like, again, one of the times where they're using his third choice goalkeeper. Obviously, they've got Carson for a long time, but Stu was really like one of the first ones to be doing that, and just really supporting Joe and helping him on his journey of what he's gone on to do in his career.
Yeah, because I mean, Pep always talks about how important Scott Carson is in the dressing room, even though, you know, he never plays, but he's such an important guy. Is that kind of important, do you think, those guys that aren't necessarily playing but are just sort of really pushing everyone else and helping them?
I think it's important after them squad players and even the guys who are injured when they're not involved, and just supporting the team and be there to give their advice and things. Like, we really did have a really strong squad for them two seasons that I was there. When you look at the strength in depth and the quality, like, people, Gail Clichy coming in, like, with the experience, signing these players who'd won things and had the experience, and even to this day now, like, my teams at the minute, Sunderland, where I've just left, they've got a really young team, and you really do need, it's starting to show now that you need these three or four really experienced players who've been there and done it to sort of get you over the line and get these things done that you need to get done.
And you're obviously there sort of on a match day, putting the kit out and everything. And then you're there. Are you kind of at the end of a game when the players come back in?
Yeah, we're there. So we'll be there before the players again, match day set up. I think when I was at Man City, we used to do it the day before. So on a Friday before a game, me and Brandon, or me and Chappie, would go over at the stadium. So we'd have a drive up the yard from Carrington, set the kit up, make sure everything's sorted. And then Chappie would look after training that day. And then we'd go back to the training ground, collect all the boots and things. Then we'd take the boots back over at the stadium, set the boots up. And obviously, with the campus just there now, it's a lot easier. But at the time, we were sort of backwards and forwards from Carrington to the Etihad and back over. And we sort of played a little game between ourselves that, like, whoever had set the kit up, if one of the players had come to us and asked us for something, then we'd be like, damn, we wanted really to have everything there set up so then players didn't have. But you could literally never ever get everything, because if you put everything out for them, they'll always find something that they want extra. That's just the nature of the beast that there's the players. Like, I think Chabby's previously spoken about Schmeichel used to have like a kit pile that was like absolutely huge. So I think, learning off Chappy was just incredible for me, and sort of going from an assistant. Actually, he was kit manager at Middlesbrough, then coming to City. He asked me in an interview, like, why would you sort of come to City as a step down in a role? Because I was kit manager, but I was like, I don't see it as a step back, because I'm coming to this obviously huge club and I'm going to learn from someone who's been doing the job for a really long time, and that it really did work out really well for me, and being a kit man and learning from Chappy everything that I did, because he was the heart of that dressing room. When you talk about characters, he was the man, like, around the place everyone knew him. He was the best, funniest, like, he was a stand-up comedian, basically working with a stand-up comedian every day, it'd be a laugh, like, it's an absolute scream. And I think sort of the reason why him and Roberto didn't really see eye to eye is because he wanted everything serious and regimented. And I mean, I really think football gets taken too seriously at times, and I think you just got to enjoy it. Like, we're so lucky and blessed to be in this environment. Like, why do you need to take everything so seriously? And Chappy was sort of there to let the lads relax a bit, and yeah.
Well, that's it. I suppose, you know, the stakes are so high and the pressure's so much that players kind of around games are going to really feel it. So it's kind of on the kit manager to have a laugh with them and kind of take away that tension and that pressure that, you know, Chappy did so well and Brandon does.
Brandon's still doing it this day, and obviously again he's learned from the last, hasn't he? So he's doing him proud, I would say now.
Straight away when you joined City, we're in Europe, weren't they? So you're sort of travelling abroad as well as up and down the country.
Yeah, so obviously the first season we were Europa League, so we're travelling to Europe, and it's my first time going to a European game. And I think unless your team's involved in these Europa Leagues, no one really takes them as seriously as the Champions League. There's not many people turn on the TV on a Thursday night to watch these Europa League unless your team's involved in it. Luckily enough, I'd been involved in it previously with Middlesbrough, and they'd gone on a decent run and got to the final. So I sort of knew what it does sort of mean to the teams. And obviously, them nights of the Poznan was sort of created when I was there. And that was incredible to see that going off. And yeah, I mean, we're travelling again. I'll go back to when I first come to the club. I'd only been there for 2 weeks. And I was getting flew to Abu Dhabi to go on a warm weather training camp for some players that were recovering and sort of commercial things. So within weeks of being at the club, I'm already jet setting away and travelling, and like, wow, incredible. And obviously, yeah, we've gone to the Europa League and we're travelling. I think we went to Dynamo Kiev, and I'm seeing players like Shevchenko play. I'm like, wow, absolutely starstruck, to be honest.
Yeah. So you were there for the first, not the first Poznan, but the Poznan that kind of inspired City to pick it up, were you?
Yeah, definitely, yeah. To see all that going off was just incredible. And the games, obviously, the results didn't go great, and the squad didn't really get bolstered until the next season for the Champions League. But, yeah, to go on these European nights was incredible.
And did you get a chance to kind of go around the cities in the days and things like that?
Yeah, so I think it'd be a long trip when we'd sort of leave on the Thursday. I think we'd train, leave on, sorry, that's for the weekend game. I think we'd probably play at the weekend, maybe on a Saturday, recover on a Sunday, Monday train, and maybe leave on a Monday, depending on how far away it is. The kit would get collected like Monday or Sunday by a company, and they'd drive it through Europe for you. And then we'd get there, we'd train the night before for like an hour, a little sort of session, and then maybe have a look around these cities, some of the places. Like, I think it was some place in Greece that we went, I can't remember where it was. Yeah, just seeing all these sort of places like that you see that come up in the Europa League that you've never even heard of before.
Yeah. But you'd really need all of the kit to be there if it's being driven through Europe by someone else. You don't want to get there and And the players go, oh, have you not got this for me?
Literally, we're taking everything. And again, because the European, the laws and the regulations of the European games, you couldn't have some of your sponsorships on training wear. So we had like a container at the training ground, and that was just full of all our European kit. And then we had, obviously, the training kit was all in the training ground. Then we had to go at this container once every few weeks when we play in Europe to get up all the European kit. They had to train in, and they had to wear for the training and for the games, the warm-up. So it was a major operation.
What was it kind of, what was the atmosphere in the dressing room at the time? You know, it was a team kind of pushing and really hungry for trophies because they'd not won one in so long.
Yeah, it was good. I would say it wasn't really as intense as it was the next season, but it felt, for me to come in this environment, I've sort of come from, let's say, normal football, league football, cup, and then see these European games, and sort of the board and the owner have put a lot of money into the club, and they've started signing some marquee players, and yeah, you need the results instantly, because if not, then ultimately the manager goes, and obviously we'd end up getting to an FA Cup final, and morale was really good, let's say. Like, there was defeats were few and far between, but I think what I will say, when things weren't going well, the manager would let it be known and he'd take it out on the players, and there's been arguments and things. Obviously, I don't know if you've seen, but literally it's come up on my memories that 13 years ago today, I think we were playing at home at Kiev, and Mario had been sent off or he'd done something, and yeah, Roberto flies into the dressing room, and we're all in there because we can't get a seat on the benches. There's that many staff. I think we'd take like, and if the stadium's full, there's literally nowhere for us to sit. We were watching the games in the players' lounge, which was initially where the Tunnel Club is now. So we're all in there watching the games on the TV screen. So we've done all this hard work all week, and you sort of want to see your rewards on the pitch, but there was literally no room for us. So we're watching all these games, and either in the dressing room or in the players' lounge, and obviously we're in there. Mario gets sent off, and Roberto comes in with a suitcase, and Louis Vuitton suitcase is getting absolutely thrown across the dressing room. I mean, he's gone mad at him. So, yeah, the vibe between the lads and the players was really good. I think, obviously, the manager was demanding a really high standard. If it wasn't going right or going wrong, he'd really let it be known.
Well, so many questions from that. But where was the suitcase from? Whose was it?
I think it was one of the, because if you go into the dressing room, I think it might have been one of the subs that didn't make the bench, or one of the goalkeepers. It was literally the first thing at hand. Right. So he's just literally come through and he's given it all the Italian. I mean, I know some Italian only through Roberto, and it's all bad language. So whenever I've met any Italian players over the years, I'll recite these words that I know fluently because I've heard them so many times being launched at Mario, maybe.
was it a full suitcase? Was it like,
yeah, it was like because the lads would stay off for the night before in the hotel, so they'd have like a, I mean, you've seen the lads with the Louis Vuitton suitcase, roller suitcase, like sort of overhead storage thing, and he picks it up and he just fires it. I don't think it hit him, like it missed, like, but yeah, you've seen these things with Roberto and Mario either daily or weekly, and obviously we had Pete. There was paparazzi there every other day at the training ground.
Yeah. It did feel like a time when, you know, City were a huge story, like, every day. Because, like you say, there was always something going on. And, like, yeah, long lenses over Carrington training ground trying to get something that was going on. But I guess there usually was something going on all the time.
I think we actually got on first name terms with the photographers. We actually knew them and seen them every day, and they were like, all right. I mean, some of them had like 6 foot, 10 foot ladders to peep over. So, and I think that there was a sort of farmhouse next door, and the guy was letting them and charging them a fee to come down and sort of use his farmland, because that was his own land. It's not belong to Manchester City. And yeah, it was a really nice training ground, and Manchester City was spending money on it, sort of advancing it, trying to get it better and better and better, until ultimately they moved to the new campus.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that is a good time to pause, and then we'll come back for part two with some more stories about the players and some more memorable moments. welcome back to part two of the Talking City podcast with Steve Aziz, former City kit man. And yeah, let's get into the games and the moments. We talked about how, you know, it was always a story at Carrington, but always a story on the pitch. So your first season at City win the FA Cup.
Yeah, incredible. One of the games obviously stands out is the semi-final against United. And I've got a picture from, I don't know if you've done anything with Sharon Latham before. She was City photographer at the time. Amazing woman. Like, she's still in the game at the minute. I think she's doing some bits of Burnley with Vincent. Still speak to Shaz. And there's a picture of me running across the pitch. And in the background, you can see Mario again in sort of hands with Rio Ferdinand. He's obviously raging with him because we're celebrating. And Rio's going absolutely bonkers. And I'm just running the past, going like, congratulate and speak to the lads. Yeah, that was incredible. And to be my first season, to be going to Wembley, obviously the amount of time City being Wembley is incredible now, but you could not get a ticket full of normally for that game. I mean, a Manchester derby at Wembley semi-final in the FA Cup, it sort of was, without taking away from winning the FA Cup, which was an unbelievable day, I think that game sort of felt a little bit more, and that was probably the final, really. Obviously, the Stoke really shop against us, and I'm really good friends with Robert Hough from my time at Middlesbrough, and I was obviously gutted for Hoothie that we'd beat him in the final. Obviously happy for myself, but to see, like, my big mate Rob was devastated that day. But that was one of the massive games that stands out for us on that FA Cup run.
I mean, it's gone down as such a huge game in sort of, you know, like a tipping point in Manchester history. And United had that banner up at Old Trafford counting the number of years that City hadn't won a trophy, and then to beat United in that semi-final, then go on and win the cup, the celebrations must have been something pretty good.
Yeah, it's giving me goosebumps a bit like that. Just thinking about that time. But I don't think we really celebrated after the United game, because we'd have been back into training, and there wasn't really any time to celebrate because the European games and the build-up of fixtures, like, there wasn't really time to have much downtime. I don't really recall. A lot of people tell you I'm really social, so if there's a chance for me to get out and have a drink and celebrate, I'll be there. But I think after that game, it was just back to the training ground and we go again. I sort of do remember the FA Cup final, because I had some friends down for that game and everyone went back to Manchester, big party. And for some reason, I ended up with my mates from Middlesbrough back in Milton Keynes, and I had the kit van with me, so I must have drove it down. And the bottom of the FA Cup, the lad to took the trophy back on the train, and I had the bottom of the FA Cup in the back of the City kit van at a hotel in Milton Keynes for some reason. But it's a good job that didn't go missing.
Yeah. And after the FA Cup, you then, you know, the season finishes and you then reconvene for pre-season in LA, which pretty nice.
Well, I think obviously it was good to end the season with the FA Cup, but also qualifying for the Champions League as well, because obviously that's huge for us going the next season. We finished third.
Yeah.
Not too far off, United win the league. I think we come level on points with Chelsea in second. But yeah, ultimately qualifying for the Champions League. So obviously everyone's really excited for that and see where that's going to take us. But we got on my first pre-season with the club, because I'd missed the last one just coming in a bit later. So we're flying to LA, we're business class. I've never flew business class before. That's bad for Middlesbrough. It's like reclining his chair back. I've turned probably left instead of turning right where I normally turn. Unbelievable. I think I'd been to Vegas previously, but I've never done Los Angeles. And sort of the hotel that the club had set us up in was the Ritz in Santa Monica. So right. We're staying sort of beachside, and we're training really hard twice a day. But we're training early because of the heat, and we're literally, I think we could be finished by like 2 o'clock in the afternoon, then it's like free time. And we're on Santa Monica, we're getting bikes down Santa Monica Boulevard, we're going to Muscle Beach, Isle Schwarzenegger place. And yes, really count myself really lucky to sort of be there. It was a long trip. I think I remember it being about 15, 16 days, and we travelled around. We'd done LA, we'd went up to San Francisco for a game, then come back, we trained. I think we played a game at the Giant Stadium. Then we come back. We went up to Vancouver, played a game, then come back to LA. And we were training at LA Galaxy's training ground. And then obviously the last day of the training was the famous Balotelli bloody spin kick that he does and gets dragged off after like 30 minutes.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and David Beckham was playing incredible. And Milner had played, I think Millie had played with them, Becks at England, and he managed to get us all a share because he gets an Escalade driven in before the game, and then half time, where obviously tidying up, tidying around, and he plays the first half and then he shoots off.
Right, so okay.
He didn't really get a chance, like obviously of the class and the high status of the man, he can't be hanging around for 90 minutes. He's shooting off, he's got things to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, luckily enough, I owe Millie one for getting us Beckham share from that game.
Because it was a game against AC Milan, wasn't it? And I'm sure everyone will have seen it, but that moment in the first half where Balotelli goes forward, he's through on goal, and then he just...
No, it was actually against LA Galaxy. Beckham was playing that game.
Oh, was it? Right.
Yeah, so I think Dzeko puts him through. I'll actually watch the highlights on my notes this morning. Dzeko puts him through, and I think he says that he hears a whistle for offside. So he just does this ridiculous, like, mad, and then everyone's booing, and Mancini pulls up.
Because as soon as he does it, Mancini's fuming, isn't he?
Yeah. So we're like, here we go again. Like, we new pre-season, we've had the suitcase last season, and let's start afresh. And we're not even finished pre-season yet, and Mario's getting dragged off in 30 minutes in a pre-season game.
Yeah. What was Mario like to work with?
Yeah, I loved him. I don't want to say no bother. He'd come past you, he'd give you a dead arm, and he was just like your baby brother. Like, he's 19 year old, ridiculous amount of money, living on his own in this new city, and felt, I don't want to say I feel sorry for him, but anyone would want to be in his shoes. But yeah, he always, I think obviously the press and the media are always really trying to find something and a story about Mario, and there was sort of loads of stories going around, and loads of them weren't true. And I don't know, the one where he turns us to the petrol station, he pays for everyone's petrol, and yeah, asking him, is this true? And he's like, no, it's not true. But then people are saying, oh yeah, it's definitely true. And the amount of times that he was getting his car towed, he was just parking it anyway on in Manchester, like, just, and the ridiculous hat to the yard. And yeah, I think Chapman really got on well with him. He sort of might have seen Chapman as a bit of a father figure as well. And they were really, really close. And anything that Mario wanted, we'd go the extra mile and make sure. But again, he looked after us as well. He was on like a really good Nike deal, and he was getting kit and clothes and trainers sent in. And if it wasn't really leery and colourful, if it was like a black or white, Mario didn't want it. So he'd like pass it on to us. And I was the same shoe size as Mario, so I got some like cast offs on him.
So many moments from Mario, but you know, very well known for some of the kit that he wore with the Why Always Me shirt in the 6-1 at Old Trafford. How did that come about?
Again, like, because Mario really got on well with Chappie, we could have just been chatting. I think we were in the back of the kit room at the time, and they're just having this conversation. I think there was probably, I think you have the pit in the newspaper, might have been in the, it could have been the MEN actually, in the kit room at the time. And Mario's like, oh, what is this? Like, why always Chappie? Why always me? And we might have been printing some shirts for the next game, which obviously was United. And he was like, the base layers that the lads wear, he was like, put on this shirt for me. His English was okay, Mario's. It wasn't really, put on this shirt, why always me? So Chappie started making it, and Chappie's getting the letters ready. And we don't have a question mark, because you don't put question marks on the back of shirts generally. So Chappie starts to fashion out this question mark. And I think we used a bit of a C and a bit of a something else. And anyway, Chappie's made the shirt, and really nobody else knows about it. So we get to Old Trafford, we set up, and obviously the game goes the way it does, and Mario does the celebration, and everyone's ecstatic, buzzing, over the moon. Like, I think there was one of Mancini's staff was a masseur, and he was demanding Rolexes for everyone. He said, if this game happens in Italy, big tomorrow, the president, he brings everyone Rolexes. We all have new Rolexes. We're like, all right, we'll see. Anyway, we get questioned, Mancini, who did the chef Mario for doing that? He got a yellow card because you weren't allowed to do it at the time. And we were just like, oh God, we're going to, well, obviously, yeah, we're getting the play because we did it for him. So yeah, that's a really good story from our time. And I think the show was the closest to the kit lads with some of the players that Mario's come to us. And he's like, put this on the shirt, and it's an iconic moment. It really is an iconic moment. It go down.
Was he always going to show it, or was it only if he was going to score?
I don't think you could have showed it if you'd have got beat 5-1 off Man City or something. You couldn't really pull it up, could you? Look like a bit of an idiot. But yeah, I think there was another thing that Brandon won't like me mentioning from that game. Vincent's come in at half time, and one of his studs was loose. And I think he might have slipped in the first half, and he'd asked Brandon like to tighten the stud up, and Brandon had like couldn't find a boot tightener or something, and he was in a rush to go out, and he tightened it up with his fingers. And Vincent's come back in after the game going buzzing, obviously we won, yes, get in, and obviously having a bit of a laugh and a joke, and he's like, Brandon, if we hadn't won this game, I would have killed you, because he had like 4 studs left in his boots.
Oh no.
So that was a bit of a funny one. Obviously, Brandon probably learned from that. I don't think he's tightened. I think me and Chad were asking if he thought he was Superman, if he could tighten his studs with his fingers. He was that strong. But like, a really incredible day, and I don't think anything like that is ever going to happen again. To go to your nearest rivals and beat them 6-1 on their patch, and to later go on that season and win the league on goal difference the way we did was unheard of.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Did you get a telling off on the day then after the game? Was it in the dressing room you got quizzed or?
I don't think it was after? No, Mancini never really come to us and tell us. I think there was the game when David Silva scored that chinking goal and he curled it in at Blackpool away. Chappie was always up for a laugh and a joke and a carry on. And we were in the back room of Blackpool training at the Blackpool dressing room. And we were having a mess on the job between us, like we always did. Like, it was just really good place to work with Chappie. Like, what a boss to have. Like, I'm, like I say, with the stand-up sort of comedian, and Mancini has come in and caught us. And this was probably one of the first times I'd seen, and just give the little wag of the finger, sort of the continental no. And the next, it was, he'd never say anything though, but it'd be the Monday, get somebody else of authority. Like, I think we had our line manager come in and he's like, look, Roberto's expressed that he's not happy with he called it levity. He didn't want any levity in the dressing room.
You obviously sort of had a difficult relationship with Mancini while you worked there. Has your opinion of him changed since you've left?
I think that my first, upon meeting Chappie after I'd got the job and I'd come to Manchester, and I think I've got to remember that I'm leaving home for the first time. I'm living in a big city. I'm 22, 23 year old. And I just want to be, you want to be liked. You want people's acceptance. And I've just left the club where I've got a lot of friends. I've been at Middlesbrough for 4 years and I've made good relationships with people. People really trust me, because that's the thing. You've got to get managers to trust you, because when the new manager comes in and they don't know who you are, they don't know if they can trust you, they're sort of a bit standoffish. And upon meeting Chappie, he's told me, like, look, don't speak to the manager, he won't speak to you. And I was like, surely Chappie's just saying that he can't be that bad. And I've gone over to Roberto and shook his hand and introduced myself, and he's given me like a limp handshake back and like continued on doing what he was doing. Must have been thinking, who's this big 6'4" guy? Like, who is he? Like, so yeah, my opinion of Roberto's not really changed. And obviously, there's been a lot of the lads done podcasts now. Jolly and I think people have come out and said things about him, and obviously what he'd done results wise, we got the trophies and things, and I'm biased, but I don't give him the credit. I give the credit to the players, and I don't want to say me, but I think a lot of managers would have won the league that season with the players that we had. And we always give the credit to the players all the time, because it was them out there, and obviously he was picking the teams, but like the array of players that we had, like, I don't think he could go far wrong. But I feel like I'm being really biased saying that, because he's gone on and he's done well with. And it really, really hurt me when Italy beat England in the final in the home Euros, because I'd worked with Gareth previously at Middlesbrough, and I knew I've gone from this manager who was really down to earth, really chatty, speaks to everyone, knows everyone's name, and I've come to this, my first foreign manager, and he's a bit different, and I'm really young and I'm maybe a bit naive, but yeah, I still look back and I still hold the same probably opinions of Roberto as I did back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, it's funny because, like you say, quite a few players didn't really get on with him, but it was kind of like his shtick, wasn't it, that like he kind of united everyone by everyone being angry at him, and they kind of used that and
possibly, yeah.
And you know, it helped. So obviously 11-12 was an amazing season. There was a 6-1 at Old Trafford, but you know, for a while it looked like they might not win the league, and there was a few iffy results. Was Sunderland one of those games?
Yeah, so Sunderland was a strange one because obviously it was over the Christmas period and I was volunteering to drive the kit van up, and I think the players were flying up, because at the time everyone was flying everywhere, and the money that's going through the club, they were like, it's no big deal just to get a private jet up to Manchester on New Year's Eve. But I volunteered, I'll drive the kit van. So obviously I got to spend the night at home, drove the kit up to Sunderland, and then got to spend the night in Middlesbrough and set the kit up, and then the lads come over, and then I got chatting to the kit manager at the time, and he sort of said he was looking for someone to come and help him. And I was probably, again, still quite young and being away from home, to get a chance to come and work up at Sunderland and living back in Middlesbrough, my hometown, I couldn't really turn it down. So I didn't really think about the game that much, because my mind was on thinking I could be getting back to living in the northeast at a Premier League team. And obviously, the result was incredible for Sunderland to win. And I think it was like the 90-odd minutes that they scored, and they beat us 1-0. And I remember, I think Harty had smashed the door, kicked the door through. And when things weren't going well for City, the City staff would always be sent out of the dressing room, the English staff, because Roberto was paranoid that the staff were leaking stories to the press. So every time there's been a bad result, I wouldn't even say a defeat, it could have been like a 0-0 or a draw in a game that we should have won, and you'd see like 10 staff like arms folded stood outside of the dressing room waiting to be told we can come back in, clear up, because we've had our debrief. So that obviously wasn't great, but obviously I'm thinking about Sunderland, and my boss Cookie, who's been Sunderland kit man for a long time, he's talking about the job could possibly coming up, and I'm more focused on that now. And obviously over the season we're speaking, and he's offered me the job, and we've gone through all the details, and I've sort of said to Chappie, like, there's a chance for me to get to Sunderland, I think I'm going to take it. But then I'd spoke to Sunderland and said, look, City are doing really well, and it looks like we might got a chance to win the league. And obviously I think City had went clear, and then United went clear, and sort of started pegging each other back, and the sort of turn of events and the results, how they went, has obviously leaded us down the road to we need to win our last game, and we're going to win the league.
I mean, there was the derby kind of at the Etihad, wasn't there?
Yeah, so the derby at the Etihad was huge. I got two friends down, Chappie and Lockhart, still speaking now, good mates of mine. They still owe me for this day, actually, because it was incredible. We sort of knew this is the game, and I still think about the game that Vinny scored the goal against Leicester, and Gary Neville, obviously, the comment about where do you want your statue, but after that game, I think Vinny sort of cemented his hero status then, because I just remember the celebration. I remember the game, the lights have gone down, the blue moon's rising, and that gives me goosebumps now. Obviously, sort of light show, there weren't really a thing then, and obviously the lights went down, the blue moon was coming up, and it really was coming up, and for us to beat them at the Etihad, sort of, we were like, right, that's us done now. We've won it. I think we had to go up to Newcastle. Again, I got a chance to go, and we beat Newcastle convincingly. And sort of that was the path towards the last couple of games, that sort of we know we need to just do what we need to do, and we've won the league.
Let's talk QPR. What were the preparations like in that week before the game? Was it calm?
Yeah, I think it was pretty normal, really. I think we thought it was done. We just need to win, so it's really relaxed. There's no pressure on us, really, because, I mean, no disrespect to QPR, but we're playing QPR. This team has got an amazing run. We just need to win our last game, and that's us done. And I think I wouldn't have liked to have seen a price on what it would have been for City to win the league that day. It would have been incredible, but I would imagine at some point it would have went a ridiculous amount, because the week leading up was really chilled, and I saw it doesn't really play back in my mind anything significant happening. We're just really relaxed and a pretty normal week.
And then it looks like a pretty normal game as City take the lead, and then it all kind of goes a bit wrong.
I think just before we were coming to the game and we've done the setup and things, and I remember having, I've still got this picture of the day, I've got this Nike t-shirt on, I've worn it as a bit of a laugh. It says, we like being on top, and sort of like we're laughing and joking, and again, really relaxed. The shirts are all put out and the boys are arriving, and yeah, it all feels really good. And then we, today, like I said, there was normally no room for us to sit, but again, I've got a picture of us. That day we really wanted to be out there to see everything, so we made sure. I think me and Chapman sat on the steps that lead up to the bench, to the seats. We're really desperate to be out there that day, and we were like, we'll sit anywhere. So I remember just sitting on the cold steps thinking, like, we need to see what's happening. Next thing we know, we're getting beat 2-1. So we're like, right, let's go back inside. And we're jinxing it, and we don't want to sort of jinx it. And obviously football, you start doing all these crazy rituals and things. So let's go back inside and we'll see what happens. And then Edin scores. So we fly back outside because if anything happens, we want to be there. And then obviously what happens next? And we obviously, none of us knew at the time about the Martin Tyler commentary. We didn't see that till obviously probably the next day. But obviously Sergio scored that goal. And one of the stats that I take from it all the time is, I don't know if it's spoken about enough, is that it's Mario's only assist that season. Which is an incredible stat for Mario's only assist, and to Sergio, I'm just so happy for Sergio as well, because he was a great guy, absolute top guy. Everyone liked him, just a joy to be around. English wasn't great, but he was just a top fella, and you sort of knew when he's got a chance, he's definitely going to take this.
Yeah, just an amazing. Well, it is the best ever finish to a Premier League season. It must have been amazing to be sort of right in the thick of it.
Yeah, and we're in there and I didn't know what to do because there's fans running on the pitch and I was like, I don't want to get mobbed. I don't know what's going to happen. So I just like ran back inside and like everyone looking for everyone, like, where is everyone? And obviously everyone regroups and like, right, we've done it. And we're buzzing. And I think it's like, obviously people are crying and there's tears and the feeling. My wife was there and I had two friends again down from Middlesbrough, which was nice to share them moments with them, to look back and to say that my wife was there with me and two of my best friends had come down for the game, and we had a right celebration that night. But I think, again, sort of to show the sort of divide that I felt that was in the backroom staff at the time, Mancini and all of his staff went to the Lowry and had a sort of celebration. The players had their own celebration at Town Hall. Amazing night.
I mean, did you feel like, because you knew then that you were going, I assume.
Yeah, I knew it was going. It was like, it couldn't have obviously asked for a better way to sign off. And there's sort of a moment where the cameraman from Sky is like panning around the bench, and then I just like dive my head into the screen. That's on Premier League, yes, all the time. And when obviously any of the anniversaries of the Aguero goal come up, like that'll always pop up. And yeah, them sort of moments that can't be taken away from you, and why we do what we do and why we've been involved and why you stick around for so long at certain places, because these moments like really hard to find.
And so you go on to Sunderland and then you manage to make headlines a year later for tweeting about Mancini.
I don't even think it was a year. I think it was like a matter of months. It was definitely the next season. Obviously we'd won the league, and I knew that how everyone felt about Roberto. But obviously a lot of things that you see, press, everything's sort of scripted, and you tend to get the same answers. And if you asked 20 of them lads how they felt about Roberto, they'd all probably tell you the same answer. And I sort of wanted to get my point out that this is how everyone really feels about him. And obviously you've seen the podcasts and players, ex-players that have come out now and spoke about the times there of how he was and how he treated people. And I feel like I was sort of getting it out there for the lads, and I think a couple of the boys text me and said, like, well done on having you say, and obviously it made the Mail Online, it made the Independent, and I had news reporters from CNN trying to do interviews and stuff, which I couldn't really do because I was at Sunderland. So I'd sent the tweet on the night, Roberto had been sacked, and went to bed and woke up to like extra 2,000 followers on my Twitter and phone calls, and I'd went in to see my press officer at work, and I was like, I think I've slipped up here, Lou. And she was like, right, we'll try and get on top of it. And we'd had an Italian manager, Di Canio, at the time, and he didn't take too greatly to it either. So the headline was Kitman Sam's Mancini. It was on the front and back page of The Sun. And it's sort of like, it almost cost me my job. I got suspended for bringing the club into disrepute because Manchester City had contacted Sunderland and said, look, you need to control your staff. And again, I think I was probably young, naive. I was 25-year-old and probably didn't know or was thinking what I was doing. But I think it just shows you like how far sort of Twitter and things have took sort of press. And everyone has, I think someone said, like, social media is the best thing in the world. Social media is the worst thing in the world because everyone gets to have the say, but obviously there's also the bad part of it as well, and that ultimately could have cost me my job.
But you managed to keep your job and stay at Sunderland.
Yeah, so I was at Sunderland for 12 years, and I've just recently left, like for family reasons. But ultimately, you can't, doing the job that you do as a kit man, you've got to give your all. And you've got to give up and sacrifice a lot of time and weekends. And we've just had a newborn. He's coming up 10 months old now, and I've got an 8-year-old, and they really need dad to be home now and sort of do all the dad and son things that you do and take the kids to the games. I'm coming down to a City game in the next few weeks. I think Aston Villa game over the Easter holidays. We do really like to come back. And like I say, I do dine out on the fact that I know it was only a short time, 18 months, but it was really incredible and eventful time. Like there was never a dull day, and I look back like with great memories. Like one of my greatest times in football. I've been doing this job for 18 years, and I think now it's time to support my wife in her career and have some time back with my boys that I've missed over the last couple of years. But I think to get a chance, I still speak to some people at Manchester City now. Obviously Brandon I speak to a lot, Steph Bircher, who works in the medical department. I still got some really good friends there, and some friends that have moved to other clubs from my time there. Lee Nobes at Liverpool, Craig Gules working in the physio department at Everton. Like the backroom staff just play just as an important role, and they've all done really, really well for themselves. When I look back at that team that we had at the time, everyone's gone on and done really well for themselves.
And it is that, isn't it? You know, like the players and the managers are there in the spotlight every day, but there are so many important people behind the scenes who are making sure that the players and the manager have got everything that they possibly need to go out and do their best.
I think a lot of managers and ones that I've taken and gotten really well from are the ones that really involve the backroom staff, because they know, and I know from speaking to Brandon still, that Pep does really value all of his staff there. It's not just the lads that you see on the bench either. It's the ones in the offices. It's the ones who getting the tickets for the players and the families, making sure that everyone is playing a massive part in getting these iconic moments, like obviously winning the treble and things getting done.
Yeah, that is that's perfect. We're gonna have to leave it there, but thanks so much for your time, Steve. It's been great. It's been really interesting to hear.
No, good. I'm glad. I hope it goes down well. Thanks for letting me share my little 18 months at Manchester City there.
Yeah, and enjoy your time with your family.
No, thanks. I just want to do a little plug of my Instagram page. It's the Kitman Steve as is. There'll be pictures and things and sort of from my time at Sunderland. I have some pictures and all things from my times and stories from times at City. And yeah, them little bits. I'm doing some Q&As with Middlesbrough. Just had me back at the club speaking about my time there in the Legends Lounge. So yeah, just sort of plug them little things.
Perfect. Yeah, that's great. And yeah, that is it for the latest episode of the Talking City podcast. If you like it, yeah, give us a review and subscribe and all of that business. And yeah, we will see you soon. Thanks. Bye.